It was a really exciting time, but as soon as the AIDS epidemic came to be, that sort of happy time was over. So that those stories that are now just a memory can be accessed in real time, and what I experience when I listen to those.
Hi, I'm Susan from Stuyvesant. You're listening to WGXC 90.7 FM, Accra.
Electromix is a series to document the history of experimental electronic music from the 50s to the 80s. Pioneers who paved the way for what was to become techno, ambient, electronica, and most of what we are listening to. Essential Culture on air every Tuesday from 11 to 12 a.m.
You have the already global networks. So my argument is very simple. The present media is too large and wasteful. From now on, we should think about the more smaller media to diverse our culture and community. I have different idea on airwave. Airwave belong to the every people, everybody. not to the states or a government. Okay, I will make the transmitter now.
Survive All, one of the nation's leading manufacturers of fallout shelters, now combines sturdy steel with durable concrete block for
a civil defense approved basement type do-it-yourself fallout shelter.
Ensure protection for your family. See a Survive All shelter today.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Alana Medlock of Kingston, New York. WGXC's sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. Become a WGXC sustaining supporter today. Go to WGXC.org and click donate. Thank you for your support.
Like a fire hydrant, like a public drinking fountain, like a park bench, WGXC is always there for you, at your service. 90.7 FM, Community Radio.
From the WGXC Newsroom, this is the WGXC News Update. Nancy Kern reports for Columbia Green Media that David Snyder was declared the winner of the Tannersville mayoral election on March 30th by a count of 103 to 102 votes. The one-vote victory came after Snyder had a two-vote lead after absentee ballots and two cured ballots were submitted to the Greene County Board of Elections. But the board ruled one of the cured or changed ballots invalid. County Elections Commissioner Marie Metzler and Brent Bogatis said that the handwriting on one of the cured ballots did not match the signatures on the ballot envelope or the original registration. Snyder said, and I quote, "I'm honored to have been elected by voters in the village of Tannersville to serve as the next mayor, in the largest election turnout in well over a decade. I'm excited to continue engaging with our neighbors as we move our community forward. I'm ready to get to work and serve our community in a collaborative manner. We have a tremendous opportunity to ensure that basic services are maintained while supporting our residents, businesses, and visitors. I look forward to working with the Board of Trustees as we map out Tannerville's future together. I want to thank Lee McGonigal for his years of service to Tannersville." End quote. McGonigal did not take the loss easily and may appeal. McGonigal said, and I quote, "They refused to open one vote. There was one letter in the whole signature they didn't like," end quote. McGonigal also mentioned voter intimidation at the polls as an issue in the results. McGonigal said, and I quote, "You're not supposed to be harassed, you're not supposed to be intimidated, you're not supposed to film people at the election place," end quote. McGonigal was first elected mayor of Tannersville in 1994, served four terms, and after a brief interruption was elected again in 2007 and has been mayor until now. Read more about this story at HudsonValley360.com. Liz Montgomery reports at Porcupine Soup that Catskill Schools went into shelter in place on March 30th after police received a false threat targeting the high school. A number of other schools in the Upper Hudson Valley also experienced similar threats this week, and several Berkshire County schools also did on March 28th. On March 27th, there was a school shooting in Tennessee with seven dead, and other threats often follow school shooting. The threat targeted Catskill High School, which has been empty all week because of a broken pipe. Read the full story at Porcupine Soup. Nancy Kern reports at Columbia Green Media that dozens of Athens residents spoke out against a tax break for Athens Generating Plant at a March 29th public hearing held by the Greene County Industrial Development Agency. The IDA wants to renew a payment in lieu of taxes or pilot for the power facility located on Route 9W, but many residents disagreed. Athens resident John Cameron said, and I quote, "Athens, unlike Coxsackie, does not have a lot of commercial tax brought into it, and we are being robbed of the commercial taxes which our town desperately needs," end quote. former Athens Mayor Chris Pfister said, and I quote, "Look at the businesses around here, little businesses, restaurants, mom-and-pop stores, whatever, none of them get tax breaks," end quote. Former Athens Town Supervisor Lee Parlamentaire said, and I quote, "It's a sweetheart relationship between Athens Gin and the IDA. The plant's not going anywhere," end quote. Others complained about natural gas-fired plants hastening climate change. If the tax break is approved, Athens Gin would only pay $5,250,000 from 2024 to 2028, $5,512,500 from 2029 to 2033, $5,788,125 from 2034 to 2038, and $6,077,531 from 2038 to 2043. And you can read more about that story at HudsonValley360.com. Fishing season for trout and striped bass begin in New York April 1st. Brook trout, trout in inland streams, and lake trout fishing seasons run from April 1st to October 15th. For inland trout, only two fish longer than 12 inches are allowed, while lake trout must be at least 21 inches long. Striped bass season runs from April 1st to November 30th. Limited to fish not less than 18 inches and no greater than 28 inches. And that wraps up the WGXC News Update. You can visit our website at WGXC.org for local weather updates, public meetings, a community calendar, or COVID-19 updates. And while you're there, please click on the Donate button to become a WGXC sustaining supporter or make a one-time donation. From the WGXC Newsroom, I'm Philip Grant. Have a good day and a nice weekend.
Our debt to the late, great Randall Robinson. I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! With Dennis Moynihan and our weekly Breaking the Sound Barrier podcast. On January 6, 2021, photojournalist Saul Loeb was in the U.S. Capitol to cover Congress's counting of the Electoral College votes. He ended up shooting some of the most iconic photographs of the ensuing insurrection. One photo shows four white men seated in the Capitol Rotunda. Behind them hangs a massive painting, The Surrender of Lord Cornwallis, depicting George Washington's military victory over the British in 1781. Two of the insurrectionists are looking up, seemingly mesmerized by the massive fresco adorning the Capitol dome. The fresco, the apotheosis of Washington, was painted by Constantino Brumidi in 1865. As described on the website of the architect of the Capitol, it shows, quote, George Washington rising to the heavens in glory. Loeb's photo brought to mind another insightful viewer of the same work, Randall Robinson, the remarkable African-American author and activist who died this week at the age of 81. Robinson was born in 1941 in Jim Crow, Virginia. After graduating from Harvard Law School, he went to work in Washington, D.C. In 1977, he co-founded TransAfrica to push for a just foreign policy towards Africa and the Caribbean. Randall Robinson was arrested numerous times in some of the most effective U.S. demonstrations against South African apartheid. He was also a dedicated champion of the Haitian people, protesting U.S.-supported coups that have decimated Haiti. Randall Robinson frequently appeared on the Democracy Now! NewsHour. In 2001, speaking about his book, The Debt, What America Owes to Blacks, he described a realization he had while viewing the Capitol Rotunda fresco.
George Washington is there, surrounded by 60 robed figures, and then there's a banner unfurled, E pluribus unum, out of many, one. But all of the 60 are white. And down on the rim of the rotunda, going around like a hat band, is a frieze that depicts scenes from American history. Describing our development as a nation from the dawn of discovery, or the age of discovery, to the dawn of aviation. But in these scenes, no Douglas, no Tubman, no Truth, no blacks at all. And then down at the floor level, there are huge paintings set back into this Arcos sandstone, these huge Arcos sandstone blocks, these huge oil paintings. And these paintings, again, depict scenes from American history, no blacks at all. And then I had begun to read on this question to discover that these sandstone blocks had been mined in Stafford County, Virginia, by slaves. They were brought up the Potomac River by slaves. They were hauled to the capital and put in place by slaves.
Not long after The Debt was published, Randall Robinson moved with his wife to her native Caribbean island nation of St. Kitts. He explained,
I wanted to live in a society for some time, some portion of my life, where race did not have to be a battlement, that one could get beyond that and not feel it always in one's craw. And it's the kind of thing that it used up so much of my energy and the energy of so many in the United States.
In 2004, I flew in a small chartered plane with Randall Robinson, Congressmember Maxine Waters, and several others to the Central African Republic, CAR. They went to retrieve Haiti's democratically elected president, Jean-Bertrand Aristide, who'd been forcibly flown there in a U.S. jet following a U.S.-backed coup d'etat. They met with CAR's dictator, François Bozizé, who said he couldn't release Aristide without U.S. permission. High-ranking Bush administration officials warned the Aristides against returning to the Western Hemisphere. On the return flight to Jamaica with the Aristides, Randall Robinson scoffed, "Whose hemisphere?" Robinson championed those battered by racism, whether in South Africa, in Haiti, or here at home. His book, The Debt, remains one of the most compelling arguments for reparations for the descendants of enslaved people. He wrote in the book's introduction of the Capitol Rotunda, quote, "I could not completely place myself outside the spell. Everything about the room was dwarfing, the scale of the art, the size of the round chamber, the height and sheer majesty of the dome. It had combined to achieve the founding fathers' objective, which was, I am certain, to awe, and to hide the buildings and America's secrets. I thought then what a fitting metaphor the Capitol Rotunda was for America's racial sorrows." Randall Robinson went on, "In the magnificence of its boast, in the tragedy of its truth, in the effrontery of its deceit, this was the House of Liberty, and it had been built by slaves," he wrote. Most of those insurrectionists who attacked the U.S. Capitol January 6th embraced Donald Trump's demand to make America great again. In his searing 2004 memoir, Quitting America, The Departure of a Black Man from His Native Land, Randall Robinson wrote, "I've tried to love America, but America would not love the ancient full African whole of me. Thus, I could not love America. I had come to know too much of her work," he wrote. For Randall Robinson's lifelong commitment to racial justice, we remain in his debt. I'm Amy Goodman with Dennis Moynihan.
And now here is your WGXC weather update. Your forecast for the weekend. Well, on Saturday, rain before 3 p.m., then a slight chance of showers after 4 p.m., but the temperature high will be near 70 degrees. And Saturday night, showers and thunderstorms before 11 p.m., then a slight chance of showers between 11 p.m. and 3 a.m. Some of the storms could produce gusty winds. The temperature low will be around 29 degrees. And on Sunday, sunny with a high near 44 degrees. And Sunday night, partly cloudy with a temperature low of around 29 degrees. And that is your weather update from WGXC, 90.7 FM, radio for open ears, in Greene and Columbia Counties.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Nora E. Edelman of Athens, New York. Sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about Creative Community Radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. You too can become a WGXC sustaining supporter by investing in community radio every month. Go to wgxc.org and click donate. Thank you for your support.
WGXC has a new call-in number for anyone to leave a 3-minute message that we will play back on the air. Listeners can leave as many 3-minute audio letters to the editor at 518-212-7509 as they want, and WGXC will let your voice be heard on the local airwaves. The number again to call in and record a 3-minute message that will be played back on 90.7 FM is 518-212-7509.
WGXC believes in creative use of the airwaves. WGXC is a program division of the nonprofit arts organization Wave Farm, based in Acre, New York. We are the only station in the country to dedicate significant airtime to radio as an artistic medium. Tune in to transmission art and experimental sound programming overnight and on Saturdays, and hear artists from all over the world who sculpt and compose with the airwaves.
Wave Farm respectfully and humbly acknowledges the past, present, and future Indigenous peoples on whose ancestral lands Wave Farm and WGXC operate and broadcast. The Mohicans name themselves the people of the waters that are never still, following their arrival along the Great Ebb Tide River, also known as the Hudson. The Mohicans stewarded this land over many generations and in dynamic communication and interaction with diverse Indigenous peoples, including the Haudenosaunee Mohawk and the Munsee Lenape. Mohican descendants today live in communities in Ontario, Wisconsin, and Oklahoma. For more information on Mohican history and the contemporary community of the Stockbridge-Munsee Band of Mohican Indians, please visit mohican.com.
You are tuned to 90.7 FM, WGXC. Hands-on, listener-supported radio for Greene and Columbia counties.
And nursing a part, we know every card by heart. Overture, curtain lights, this is it. We'll hit the heights, and oh, what heights we'll hit. On with the show, this is it.
Yeah. him, so he died. She said, you're pretty good with words, but words won't save your life. And they did, so he died. And he was drunk and exhausted, but he was critically acclaimed and respected. He loved the Gold Gophers, but he hated all the drawn-out winters. He likes the warm feeling, but he's tired of all the dehydration. Most nights are kind of fuzzy, but that last night he had total retention. And his Twin City kisses, they sound like clicks and hisses. We all come down and drown in the Mississippi River. Dry up and now we crumble into dust. We get wet and we corrode and now we're covered up in rust. We drink and we dry up and now we crumble into dust. We get wet and we corrode and now we're covered up in rust. She was a really cool kisser and she wasn't all that strict of a Christian.
Next, we tune in the latest episode of the I Have Seen Niagara radio theater show from G. Lucas Crane and Rick Royer. The show airs Saturday mornings on the WGXC Morning Show between 9 and 10 a.m. and every early Wednesday night just after midnight.
Niagara Falls, city of wonder, city of light. A city where nature's full range of sublime power and terrific beauty are on display. From the Maid of the Mist to the Devil's Hole, from Suicide Point to the country's largest sect of traditionalist, mystic, psychic hydroculturalists. There's too much to enjoy in just one day. So stay a night with us, or stay forever right here at Hotel Niagara.
Uncle knows how much this trip means to me. Most boys my age have already become men in our community. Some have even taken wives and assumed prominent roles in the farmhood. But my passage to maturity has been waylaid by my weak heart and a proneness to boils. So to accompany my uncle, the most respected figure in the Isidorian community, on a long journey to survey some land in Canada that may indeed be our future home, fills me with profound pride. We have been driving northeast from Ohio on a hot summer day for about 6 hours. So far on the journey, there's been very little conversation. Uncle knows better than to waste words when they're not necessary, but I can't wait to rattle off the many stories from our travels when I return home to my friends and siblings, like when I saw the crazy three-wheeled motorcycle or the green dinosaur statue at the gas station. That was funny. I don't know much about this trip. Uncle only told me we were meeting some other Isidorians to potentially purchase several acres of fertile green land, with many a gully for the farming of water. I've heard rumors of a massive project in the works, where Isidorians from across the country are joining up to cross over to the other side together. The other side of the border, I'm assuming. On the peninsula where the mighty Niagara River meets Lake Ontario. There is a nearby colonial-style town there, I'm told, where we can sell our produce and crafts and distribute The Sunflower, our monthly newsletter of water, agriculture, and faith. The location also happens to sit near what our holy books refer to as hydro-terrestrial correspondence points of divine energy, which converge close by. Uncle knows that this is the right time to move the community. A move like this would offer a new beginning. Not only have we outgrown our homestead in Ohio, but our community has struggled greatly of late since the terrible disappearance of my young cousin Elijah last summer. As for me, I am giving my all to suppress my uncomely hopeful giddiness. The trees along the highway go by in a blur, but the miles cannot be covered fast enough, as I just cannot wait to be one of the first to set eyes on this new land of promise, where I may one day raise a family and pull my firstborn from the rising water of a deep well, just like Saint Isidore. We are now entering New York State, and the feeling in my heart is growing more intense and may not be entirely attributable to anticipation. When I press my hand to my chest, I feel my heart pound with no discernible rhythm. It is more like a spasm than a beat, and there is an annoying twitch underneath each eyelid. As I close my eyes, I see colors that I have never seen before or imagined, slowly expanding outward, colors and patterns bleeding into each other, creating spirals, marbling, and sometimes exploding and dissolving like a show of fireworks. Time is flickering. Here now, out now, here now. I open my eyes, but instead of the highway in front of me, I see my sister's face, smiling into a white beam of crystal sun. The animals from our farm seem to be smiling also. Beyond them in the distance, I see a woman in white running on water with two hounds beside her. And now there is nothing. I cannot move. I am paralyzed. No, I have completely shut down. Everything has let go. I am not alive. My eyes have closed, but I can still see everything around me in some sort of wide circle of vision outside of my body. I see my uncle sitting next to me, totally unaware of my passing. I didn't even have a chance to say goodbye to him. I didn't say anything at all. I was too distracted by the sensation of dying for it to properly register as death. I never really got to know Uncle and assumed this time spent with him would be a chance to learn about him and from him. Instead, he barely said a word to me, and now here I am, lifeless in the seat next to him. I wish there was some way to communicate with him now, but it doesn't seem possible. I am completely severed from my body, as if trapped in a frightening dream from which I cannot wake. But this is not a dream, and I am not afraid. I have been dead for nearly 2 hours now, and Uncle has yet to realize it. My head has fallen to the side, with my mouth gaping wide open, a position that one could easily interpret as deep sleep. The last sign on the road said we were entering Buffalo. That was 20 minutes back. And now Uncle is pulling off into a service station. He mumbles something about urination. My lack of response does not seem to faze him. We pull into the parking lot. Uncle gets out and stretches his arms and back. He pulls a bottle of juice from a pocket in the car door and finishes it. He opens the back door and tosses the empty bottle in. He grabs some seeds from a Ziploc bag while he's back there and pops them into his mouth. He chews and looks down at his feet on the hot pavement. Finally, he addresses my corpse.
"Okay, Joseph, time to wake up now,"
he says from the outside of the open door. He ducks inside the car from the driver's side, slightly annoyed, and shakes my shoulder good.
"Joseph, hey, Joseph, Joseph."
My head rolls back on my neck and lands with a thud against my window. Uncle simply nods. He looks to see if there are any people around, and now slides back into the car. He whispers, shakes me rough, licks his fingers to check my pulse, nods again. Uncle now starts the car, but only drives it a few yards back into the service area parking lot where there are no cars around. He is rolling his phone in his hand, unsure if he should use it or not. Uncle knows that he can't call an ambulance right now. Authorities will not allow him to continue transporting my body, and it's against our religion to allow a body to be handled by someone other than a member of our faith, or to inject a body with chemicals and all that stuff they put in a body before burial. Our natural bodies must be tossed in a river as soon as possible after death. Uncle fully reclines my seat to make it look all the more as if I am sleeping. He cracks a window, and he walks towards the service area, disappearing into a building that says it has a McDonald's, a Sparrow Pizza, a Burger King, a Starbucks, a pretzel factory, and a Frank's Loaded Taters, all under one small roof. Even though we are prohibited from eating this kind of food, it's too bad that I cannot join my uncle to experience such a fascinating place. Uncle has now been in the service area for more than 40 minutes. He must be collecting his thoughts and making arrangements for how to handle the situation. Many thoughts have gone through my own head, if it is indeed my head that thoughts go through now, but they are surprisingly removed from feelings. I can say that I will miss my family. I can say that I am afraid of what's next. I can say that I am disappointed that my life has been cut so heartbreakingly short. But honestly, I would only be saying these things. I have no feeling about any of it, really. No sadness, no fear, no real longing. Suddenly, everything just is, and I cannot force myself to feel any other way about it. So far, death is not quite what our holy book said it was going to be like. But as with everything else, I don't feel anything about it. All I feel is a strange openness, as if my spirit self is one big orifice. My uncle is now emerging from the service area, carrying a bag. It is a bag from McDonald's. He opens his door and places the bag on the floor beside his feet. Uncle must have been so very hungry from grief at my passing that he had to break our usual dietary restrictions and choose hot, substantial food over the breads and dried fruits that we have packed for the journey. He starts the engine, eats some fries that he had stored in his shirt pocket, picks at his ear, looks at me, and races back out onto the highway, causing my head to do a full circle until it lands squarely on the dashboard. We've reached the last exit before the border, in Niagara Falls, New York. Uncle must realize there is no going further. He knows he cannot bring a dead body across the border. This is as far as we go. He pulls into a motel. The sign looks old and melted. The name of the establishment is indiscernible. There are no other cars in the parking lot. There's an ice machine, a sun-bleached old pop vending machine, and a huge mound of discarded belongings taking up two parking spots. This is not any kind of place that people in our community usually stay, but these are extreme circumstances, and Uncle knows best. He hurries into the motel office, which, like the rest of the motel, looks abandoned. But he inserts a coin into a large bronze machine on the desk, and a key pops out. Uncle returns to the car, collects his McDonald's and a small travel bag, and heads into the motel room, leaving me in the car. I am alone and dead, which is no different, I have come to understand, from being dead and in the presence of others. Uncle has been in the motel room for nearly an hour. Everything has been very quiet. There hasn't been any activity in this motel. Uncle has occasionally opened the door of the room to check on the car. He does this again now, looking to the left, then the right. He is thinking. He approaches the car this time and opens the door to check on me. It's quite late at night, but the temperature has barely dropped. I can't say that my body is smelling very good in this muggy air. Some of what was inside of me has also leaked out. Not a lot, just a slow release of some excess pee and poop. Enough to make an enclosed area disagreeable, and that is apparent from my uncle's facial expression. He leaves me, but quickly returns with a sheet. He wraps my body in it the best he can, continually keeping a lookout around the parking lot. Then he pulls me out of the car. I'm half hanging in, half hanging out, all twisted up in the sheet, which is now barely covering anything. He wraps my arm around his head and lifts me up, carrying me like a big swaddled baby in his arms. I like that. He struggles, but reaches the room, closing the door behind him with his foot and dropping me as gently as he can on the carpet. He drags me by my ankles to the bathroom and lifts me up into the tub. He turns on the shower, letting it run cold on me while he runs out of the room, grabbing a small plastic garbage can on the way out. He returns with that garbage can filled with ice from the motel ice machine and dumps it into the water with me. Uncle can now relax a bit. He checks around the room, opens the small fridge, then looks under the bed. Uncle is curious. Either that, or he is looking for something. He looks to the night table drawer and slowly opens it. Nothing in there. He opens the second drawer below and pulls out a shirt that must have been left behind by a previous guest. It's a brightly colored shirt, well worn but folded neatly. It's the type of shirt I sometimes see being stored in crates at the auction house. I believe it's called tie-dyed. Uncle inspects the shirt thoroughly, rubbing the material between his thumbs and forefingers. He even presses it to his face and holds it to his forehead. He smells it good. He brings it with him as he sits by my body in the iced tub. He puts his head down on the back of his hand against the plastic lip of the tub. Poor Uncle is exhausted. He remains in this position as he finishes his leftover cheeseburger. He returns to the bed, lays back and puts the tie-dyed shirt over his face. He stays like this for some time without moving, just breathing, with the shirt covering his face and his hands to his sides. Now he moans. He breathes in, moans louder, lower. Now he is silent, his breaths getting longer, deeper, the shirt rising and falling with each breath. He turns over onto his stomach as if in a trance. His face is sleepy and doughy like a baby. It rests flat against the bed. He slides the shirt along the bed and against his chest. Two-fisted, he squeezes it to his body and wrinkles up his face. He curls his legs up, making himself into a ball. Now he rocks himself from side to side, first slowly, now faster he goes. He holds the tie-dye shirt tight near his parts. Oh, now he is pumping it into the air as he rocks and bringing it down into his face, which he throws back and forth. He is expressing himself in a very peculiar way for a grown man, seemingly both attacking and cuddling the t-shirt. He is pumped up and down perhaps 10 times now, faster and faster. His eyes are closed. 20 more pumps with his whole body into it now. And suddenly his eyes pop open, and he abruptly stops, jumps to his feet, and he tosses the shirt at the baby blue curtain in front of him.
What do you care? What does it mean?
Now he peeks out the window, barely pulling the curtain back. Just enough to peek out. He turns, looks to the carpet, and makes an exasperated fist at it. Something is troubling Uncle. He picks up the t-shirt from the floor, holds it in his arms, and weeps. Is he crying for me? Is he crying for Elijah? Is he crying for some other reason that I just don't understand? Whatever the reason, the t-shirt comforts him. His cries turn into a laugh as he curls up on the bed with the shirt, rests it against his cheek, and falls asleep. It is morning now, just after dawn. Uncle is making the bed and preparing to leave. With the exception of a single shriek coming from somewhere outside in the distance, the night has been extremely quiet. At one point, Uncle woke up to use the bathroom. When he was finished, he sat down beside me and observed my body. He moved my arm up and down, surely noticing some stiffness. He opened one of my eyelids and looked into my eye. His head circled as if he were looking for something behind my eye. And then he touched my eyeball. He pressed it a little more firmly a second time to see what would happen. And his finger went right through my eye, knuckle deep. Then he closed my eyelid again. He smiled as he wiped his finger on his slacks. After Uncle left the bathroom, he removed all of his clothes, except for his large black traditional beaver hat, which I've never seen him remove. And then he did some stretching in total nudity before putting on the tie-dyed t-shirt. He ran his hand round and round the front of it, then traced the designs on the front with his finger. It was at this point when I could clearly see what was printed on the shirt. "Keep truckin'," it said. And below it was a very pleasant parade of dancing bears. A delightful shirt, although not very modest. It looked very tight on him, but he was comfortable enough to sleep in it. He slept peacefully for the rest of the night. Uncle is very careful in returning me to the car, loading me into the back seat, draped in the same white sheet. He is still wearing the tie-dyed shirt. He stands out near the hood of the car and removes his hat. For the first time in my life, I can see his hair, a waterfall of long, matted locks. He gives a grin and flings his hat like a saucer onto the pile of garbage in the parking spot next to us. He slowly walks over to the driver's seat, gets in the car, and then looks back to address me.
Ready to help us all cross over, Joseph?
By way of some holy miracle, I respond. Some not quite human sound emanates from my mouth while my tongue hangs out of it. Uncle drives on towards the Rainbow Bridge to Canada with a satisfied look on his face. He turns on the radio. It's a strange song about a man named Casey Jones.
Most radio shows don't come with a demonstration, but most radio shows aren't Radio Wonderland.
Greatest hits.
right? So then I take more pieces of live radio, slice them, fit them into the groove, and then in a few minutes you get something like...
Back in LA, some restrictions apply.
It's radio made completely out of radio. I'm Joshua, but you just call me Radio Wonderland.
10:30 a.m. Saturday mornings till 11.
Some restrictions apply.
Hi, folks. Before we begin taping today, I'd like to introduce you to Mr. Peter Jenks of the Federal Communications Commission. Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Barris.
I don't know if any of you are aware of this, but it's a federal offense to make lascivious remarks on a television network broadcast. The penalty for this disgusting, un-American behavior is 1 year in prison, or $10,000 fine, or both. Anyone making a sick, subversive remark tonight will be arrested immediately. I then will personally escort the offender to federal prison for booking under Edict Number 364 of the Broadcasting Act of 1963. And it's a long drive to that prison, baby. Just you and me. No witnesses.
Okay, have fun, buddy. All right.
Yesterday's love.